People say less is more. At Red Barn, we think less is better. It's what you won't find that sets our natural premium pet food apart. No byproducts, no corn or soy, no fillers. Just the natural ingredients your pets need to live the healthy life they deserve. Look at the label. We want you to. Red Barn Naturals Pet Food. Simply the best. Find it in your local pet specialty store. Visit redbarninc.com/coupon to save a dollar off your first can.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of La Femme de Prose. I am Musui, and I will be your host. Thank you, and welcome again to another awesome episode. We have two guests lined up for you tonight, and it is in our continued awareness in the month of May, being Mental Health Awareness Month. So before we get into that, I want to give you guys the usual reminders. If you would like to connect with us on Facebook, please do so at facebook.com/LaFemmePros. You can always also connect with us on Twitter, twitter.com/FocusOnWomen3. And actually, our handle is at FocusOnWomen3. Sorry about that. That's at FocusOnWomen3. For all of our authors that we have featured on the show, you can check out their information and their book info for purchases at FocusOnWomenMagazine.com. All right, so we have, like I said, we have two guests. And first up is Dr. Pierre Milo, who is a therapeutic counselor, and he is going to be on here tonight to share his story of dealing with loss. And in our second segment, we're also going to have a speaker, Helga Loes, who specializes in dealing with trauma. All right, so we want to welcome Dr. Milo. Hello, Dr. Milo, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, it's my pleasure.
Okay. All right, so you are a therapeutic counselor and you help people deal with stress and grief. But you're here tonight to also talk about your book. Let's start off first with you giving us a little bit of your background information, if you didn't mind.
Well, yeah, for a number of years, I was, years ago, I was a police officer in the city of Montreal. And then after a number of years, I became a professional musician for quite a while. And then, as I was a musician, I started to get interested in the psychology and religion, which was always a very interesting subject for me, and spirituality. So one thing led to another, and I first started into this field by studying martial arts. And through martial arts, I got involved into Zen meditation and breathing exercise. And so one thing led to another, and I've grown interest in this. And I started to actually went back to university as a mature student and studying psychology and studying religion. And years after years, I studied, and I got involved with a center that's called the Spiritualist Center for Psychic Studies in Montreal, and that's where I really got involved further into all the spiritual Eastern philosophies and pranayama, yoga, breathing exercise, and as I was, and then I opened a practice as a therapist after I became one. And I noticed that as I was going along, stress was kind of a main subject that people suffered mm-hmm. from. And if I started treating stress, a lot of the problems sort of disappeared by themselves. So I further mm-hmm. my studies into stress management, and I developed a nice little program. It's a 4-week program on stress management, and I started to apply that in private mm-hmm. practice. After that, I did it as a workshop, which I've given to mm-hmm. a number of companies and privates. And mm-hmm. I even wrote a little book about it.
Okay.
And it's called Power Up Your Life and Make Stress Work for You. It's a very simple method. And then I was going along doing this, and what led eventually into the grieving aspect of my practice is when my wife got sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided at that point that I would become her main sole caretaker, and which I did for 3 years, full-time, 24/7. I just dropped everything and became her, I didn't really have time to do anything else.
Yeah.
So after, and then I learned a lot, of course, because as I was doing this, I was reading on, the disease that was afflicting her, which was ovarian cancer, and she was going through these stages of relapse and remissions, and which is typical to ovarian cancer. And that lasted for 3 years, and of course, I've learned a lot, and after she passed away, and after I've, worked on my grief and went through it, and I saw the importance of focusing my energies on helping others grieve, because I felt so miserable. I felt so out of sorts, out of touch. That so after a year, I reopened my practice, but at that point, I really focused on grieving, and even went a little further, and I specialized also in the end of life. I became a palliative care facilitator, which I added to my practice. Yeah, so in essence, now what I do is I'm a therapeutic counselor, but I'm also focusing on grief and end of life facilitating.
Okay.
That's how I get to where I am now, and that led me to write my book. A number of people were always saying, "Well, you should write a book about your experience," and but I wasn't really ready. And I thought that when I would be ready, then I would do the move. And at one point, I felt I was. And the reason why I did this is on the market so far, they weren't. There's a lot of book on, of course, people relating their own experience as either going through cancer, getting better at it, and explaining how they go through and all the emotions. But I had very rarely seen anything that was written by the perspective of the caretaker.
Okay.
And so I thought it was something I would like to write about, and that's what I did, write about my experiences and the different stages of grief and everything that has to do with grieving. But I didn't want to do it as a therapeutic tool, because there are a lot of books, theoretical books out there. I wanted to write it as I went through it myself, as an experience. So the book reads like a novel, and basically that's how I became a therapist. And where we are now.
So the book is basically based on your experience as being a sole caretaker and the different things. It tells a story, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And can
all
you
the experiences
that, the title of the book?
Excuse me?
The title?
Yeah, it's Rising from the Ashes of Loss, My Voyage Through Grief.
Okay.
And I thought that the title was it took me a little while to find something that was really saying everything it needs to be said. And the book actually, in essence, what it's all about is it starts when Louise, my late wife, got diagnosed with cancer, and how I started taking care of her. And but it was it's all written from my perspective, the perspective of the caregiver, which is really a draining experience for anybody that went through it. And
mm-hmm.
I thought it would be helpful. It was a real catharsis for me to write the book, first of all. And I thought
wow.
it would be a catharsis for people who read it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book explains how I started, how I really went down and into despair and pain and, you know, going up and down through the process of anticipatory grief, and how I had hopes. Well, we had hopes that the cancer would go away and that she would get better. But then all of a sudden there was a relapse, and you know, how despairing it became for both of us.
Yeah.
Me, since, you know, I'm the caretaker, that she was in essence going back down, and all the while facing the fact that I was losing my wife, and that you know, she was going to die. Then once this was, you know, I faced that and I sort of accepted that, then that's the hard part of anticipatory grief. She started to get better again. So here comes the hopes that she would get better, the hopes of a new life, and so on and so forth. Yeah. And then again, going back down. So what I wanted to express is what a caretaker goes through when something like that occurs. So the book is about that, how low I became and how high I was, and it guides the reader all through the experience until she dies here in our house, in my hands, basically, because the social services had almost established or built up like a hospital room here in our living room. So she died here, and then how the book explains how I, you know, the different difficulties I went through overcoming the grief for a year, and now after I overcame this, how I progressively rebuilt my life, and not only rebuilt it but learned from it. And so the book aims to show that even though you go through extreme pain, and in the book I express that through several periods at that point, at the lowest point where, you know, suicide and death for me was an option.
Wow.
And I seriously considered that, and how, you know, through the help of invisible helpers, I managed to go through and eventually, you know, learn and become a new man and go through all the process of grief. So all through that was going on, I was learning and taking courses with the Breeze Families of Ontario, the hospice in Cornwall, and helping out people go through the end of their own lives. And so that's what the book talks about. Excuse me?
Okay. Oh, no, I was going to ask you a question. Your definition of grief, is it different now than it was before you experienced the loss of your wife? Did your definition of grief change? How do you define grief?
Grief is really, my gosh, how could I say it? It really changes your life. I can't say that I perceive it. Once you're in it, you just don't think about what it is. You're too busy fighting for your life, fighting for your energies, fighting every day. It's just like your life is just, your whole life is disappeared, and you're not even considering a new life. You're just fighting moment from moment. And now, of course, I can't say I see it differently. I wasn't actually considering anything. I was just, struggling to every minute of every day. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, that I'm out of it, or sort of, because you're never really out of it. I mean, it changes your life, and your life is forever different. Even though I have gone through, because I'm a therapist, and because I've new coping mechanism, I sort of did my own therapy as I was going through it, and that, which of course helped me to go through it and free myself of all the stages of grief, the denial, the bargaining, the sadness, the resentment, the guilt. There is still something that remains after you've surmounted all the difficulties. So. Grief is grief. I mean, I could read you excerpts of the book and how people define grief, and but it's just a period. You see, what I'm trying to do when I give lectures, and what I want to do, when I aim to do in my book, is to normalize grief. Too often, when we meet a people which is grieving, what happens is stimulates emotions in other people that are close to grieving people, but emotions that those people are not sort of ready to face. It brings out their own grief that they haven't expressed, let's say, for years. So what people tend to do is they allow the person to grieve for a certain time, like a week, 2 months, 6 months. But then after that, they expect the person to just go on with their lives, and that's it. But but that doesn't really happen like that. And what I want to tell people is that to grieve is normal, and to go through these experiences is normal, and there's no timeline on grieving. Some people get around to dealing with grief in a very short period of time, while others, 6 months, a year, 10 years after, they're still struggling with some emotions. Nobody experiences grief the same way.
Now, is when it comes to separation anxiety, Does that help the grieving process, or is it just a normal part of it that people just have to go through?
I think because of what I've seen in support groups, I think that in most theoretical books on the different stages of grief, they don't brush that subject very often.
Okay.
I myself did not experience separation anxiety until I met a new person in my life and became attached to that person.
Okay.
I've never had separation anxiety before, never even close. But after I lost Louise, then the sense of loss and abandonment, which I won't go through, but it is a normal reaction into every human being, was triggered very, very powerful. And I couldn't do anything about that because she was gone and there's no way I could bring her back. Death is really final, and that's what is so hard. But when I met a new person, which is Christine, what I talk about in my book, I started to get attached to her, and then the monster showed its ugly head. Like she was leaving, we've been together 2 or 3 days, and then she was leaving, and then all of a sudden I was panicking that I was going to lose her that I was going to be alone and in pain again. Mm. And that process just kept increasing and increasing, and until I had to do work on it. But to be frank, it took me, like I've been with that Christine, with that new person for maybe 4 years now. And
wow.
that separation anxiety problem just maybe a year ago started to phase out, and I started to get better. And only now I can, you know, say I'm sort of somewhat normal. But there's
yes.
still some instances where I'm afraid to go through that process again and then lose her again, and, you know, like be in pain, and, you know. So it is an important factor, I think, in grieving in people. It probably occurs more in the death of a spouse than in the death of a parent, for instance, unless the relationship with the parent is like really intense, and, you know, the level of grief we go through always depend on the relationship we have with the deceased person. Yeah.
Now, we're talking about the loss of a spouse. So how is it when dealing with the loss of a child? Is there separation anxiety involved in that? What is that like?
There could be separation anxiety. I think there is separation anxiety just about any type of grief, because we experience a loss. And we experience the loss of a person that we have a relationship with, who we may depend or not depend in our everyday life, which makes it worse if we depend on it in our everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that even with the death of a child, there is also separation anxiety. There are different types of loss, of course, and they're all they're all difficult. And as I said before, it depends mainly on the relationship we have with the person. They say that when you lose a parent, you lose your past. When you lose a spouse, you lose your present. And when you lose a child, you lose your future. So it becomes difficult to lose your future, because, especially if you have an only child, you build, you know, ideas of what your life's going to be, what they're going to give you grandchildren, and sort of hopes for the future just instantly disappears. And in my view, it is one of the most difficult loss. I have experienced both.
Wow.
I've lost my son, my 18-year-old son. He was a soldier in training, and he died in a training accident.
Wow.
That was many, many, many years ago, and that traumatic death is extremely difficult, because it's like a shock. You don't experience it, and, you know, it's not in the normality of things that you should lose a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, yes, one of the most difficult. The most difficult one, I would say, is the loss of a child by suicide. That involves a lot of anger and a lot of guilt. And those are two emotions that are extremely difficult to get over. Because, you know, when a person kills themselves, you know, you say, was I not important enough for him or her to, you know, stick it out and live?
Okay.
And was I not, you know, worth it? So there is this big sense, again, of abandonment, again, separation anxiety, but with the guilt on top of it. So it may take people years and years and years, to get over that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's most likely a lot of unanswered questions, which just, you know, probably makes things even worse.
I mean, it is complicated. And then there are the other types of grief, which is non-socially accepted, which you can't grieve because you you don't want to talk about it, and it's sort of relationships, or sometimes it doesn't even involve a relationship. Grief can involve the loss of a job, the loss of a profession, a divorce, a very difficult separation is also a very important grief.
Yeah. So if you could highlight some of the pointers or factors that you use and that can be used to heal and to move on and to rebuild one's life.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my book, I talk a lot about different coping mechanisms. The one thing that you definitely need to do, and it seems in essence easy to say, but it's not easy to do, is that you need to talk about your loss. You need to talk about the emotions that you go through. And I say it's hard because people in society do not let you do that, because the minute that you start talking about your pain, it sort of triggers other people's pain, and they're not ready to deal with that. So what they tend to do is, in a polite way, ask you to shut up, really. Yeah. And there are different ways, different signals that people will give you. Or if they can't do that, they will just leave you. They will not call you anymore. They will not see you anymore. Yeah. They will disappear. So I say, in essence, you need to talk about it. So you have to find, even if you have one person that is non-judgmental, that would just let you talk ad infinitum, you know, like talk about your loss, talk about the person you lost, and will not, you feel that that person will not judge you, that will not be impatient with you, and that may take weeks, months, years. Nobody's timeline is the same. Now, if you can't find a person like that, and sometimes it's not a family person, it could be a friend, a coworker, somebody who's got a, you know, we all say we need a shoulder to cry on, and I think in grieving it's important that we do. Besides that, there are support groups that will give you that opportunity to just sit and express yourself, express your grief amongst a group of other people that have gone through similar experiences. I was lucky enough, in Ontario, Canada, we have what's called an association that's called Bereaved Families of Ontario. And these are several areas where they have groups that you can go, and you can sit in groups a couple of times a month and talk about your loss. In the United States, there's a Compassionate Friends, I think, that is specialized in the loss of a child or a sibling, and they have different areas, different towns all across the United States. They can do that. Sometimes health services, hospitals, hospice will offer grieving support groups. So that would be the second best option.
Okay.
But mainly, if you're not thinking about going into therapy or seeing a grief counselor or a grief facilitator, seeking a group like that would be probably the best way. So in essence, you need to talk about your grief. You need to express it. You need to let the energy go out.
Absolutely. Okay. So, Dr. Mulo, if you could share with us, because we're going to go ahead and wrap it up now, if you could go ahead and share with us, share with the listeners how they can reach you if they are interested in buying your book, or if they are interested in contacting you directly, where can they go?
Okay, well, my book is available, of course, on online. Amazon, Barnes & Nobles. They just have to go do a Google search, for instance, and just say my name, Pierre Mulo, grieving, and or just go on Amazon and search book and Pierre Mulo. So the book is available as a hard copy or as an e-book. Or they could simply call me or email me. I can give you a phone number where I can be reached. It's 613-528-1725.
Okay.
Or simply
and
email me at, excuse me?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Please, you can give the email.
Yeah, the email address is pierremilocoaching@gmail.com.
Okay. All right. So, listeners, the name of the book is Rising from the Ashes of Loss, My Voyage to Grief.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
By Dr. Pierre Milo. And he can be reached at 613-528-1725. And you can email him at pierremilocoaching@gmail.com. Okay, Dr. Milo, I do thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your story with us. And,
My greatest pleasure.
Yes, and we look forward to having you on again. I do thank you.
Well, I sure hope so. It was a very pleasant experience.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh, bye.
All
right, everyone, we're going to go ahead and move on into our second segment. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break, and we will be right back. All right, everyone, we are back, and welcome to our second segment. And before we move on into the segment, I just want to remind everyone, if you are interested in promoting your business, an upcoming event, your brand, or whatever it may be, we are definitely supportive of that. You can reach out to us by sending an email at shewhoascends@gmail.com. That's shewhoascends@gmail.com, and we will be more than happy to accommodate you. We have advertising packages that are reasonable and available as our audience continues to grow. All right, so I want to go ahead and introduce Ms. Helga Loest, who is a speaker, and she's here to talk to us about the different aspects of trauma. Helga, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So we usually start off by having our guests introduce themselves and let the audience know, how you came into this area, this topic that you speak of with trauma.
Sure. So my name again is Helga Loest, and I am a senior manager of communications at Apt Associates, which is a large government contractor in Bethesda, Maryland. A lot of the work that I do is focused on behavioral health and trauma. And so the way that I sort of came into this work and have become a national expert on trauma originated from an event that happened to me in my early 20s, more than 20 years ago. And I was at the time traveling with my mother in southern Florida, and we fell victim to a random act of violence, actually an attempted murder. So I was nearly beaten to death and had very serious injuries to recover from after that. What struck me pretty profoundly at the time was how differently my mother and I responded to what happened and what we each needed to do to heal from that. So while we went through the very same experience, we were there at the same place at the same time because our backgrounds were different. We were at different ages, you know, because we had different personalities and each person is unique, we had a very different response to the traumatic experience. And so that kind of kick-started my interest and research and study into the nature and impact of trauma and how profoundly it can affect someone's life, really every aspect of their life. And then the second part of that, and I think it's the more important part, is what needs to happen to really heal from the trauma, to live well again, and to live a healthy life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So thank you for sharing your story with us. It's a very powerful one. I wanted to also start off with, you know, defining trauma. You know, what is the actual nature of trauma in your terms?
Sure. So the nature and impact of trauma is, you know, if you look at the trauma umbrella, it covers quite a lot of different experiences. It's violence, terrorism, war, abuse and neglect. It's poverty. And these are things that I don't think any one single family gets through a generation without one person in the family being traumatized in some nature or form. Trauma is a pretty common experience. I sometimes joke with my friends that, you know, by the time you've reached your 40s, you've lived some life. And that living of life sometimes has, you know, it means not so pleasant experiences. It means feeling the impact of that trauma and figuring out how best to move on from it. The way that the common ways that most people respond to trauma, especially in the early aftermath and then in the, you know, few years after, but a lot of people will look for ways to cope if they don't understand how the trauma is affecting them. So they may experience things like sleep difficulties, sleep disturbance. They may feel anxious at times. They may want to be spending more time on their own and isolating, not going out with their friends or not wanting to be around crowds. These are all really not normal responses. And then some of the ways that common ways that people cope are with substances, either alcohol or drugs. Sometimes it's self-injury. Sometimes it's promiscuity. Sometimes it's anger and violence. You know, we see with our returning veterans that many are getting involved in the criminal justice system, being arrested and going to veteran courts. And, you know, sometimes the trauma affects us at a level where we're making choices that we may not have otherwise have made, but we're doing what we feel needs to be done to stay safe and also to just survive, you know, survive the feeling or the aftermath as best we can.
Absolutely. And with, you know, I wanted to get into childhood trauma, and I had a question about that.
Sure.
Does it exist or are there studies to show that when it comes to certain traumas, it's quote unquote, you know, blacked out, like we are reacting to something, but we don't remember what happened to us. And I think that can be applicable when it comes to childhood. Certain things may have happened to us as children, and then as adults, you know, it surfaces and we're behaving a certain way, but we really don't know why. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. And so, you know, for children that experience trauma, They get sort of the double whammy, because it's not just the traumatic experience and the lack of safety that they're feeling in that moment, but it's happening at a time when they're developing. They're developing socially, they're developing mentally, they're developing physically, and so one of my colleagues once said, you know, it's in trauma becomes a part of the fabric of who you are. And I think it's especially so with children, because, you know, if you think about how your worldview really shapes over your childhood, it's, you know, so much of that is affected by how your parents treat you, how safe you feel in your own home, if you were bullied in school, if you felt safe in school. And, you know, if there was maybe one person that you, one safe adult that you felt you could trust, count on, rely on, maybe see as a mentor, I think that can make all the difference in the world for a child. But, you know, I know from the work that I've done in and around trauma that early childhood sexual abuse and child abuse in the family, those are experiences that are some of the most difficult to heal from in, you know, in teen years and in adult life.
Absolutely. Yeah, and when you're dealing with these people who have gone through that, do you find, do you ever find that they have blocked it out over the years without their realizing it, or is it something that is so vivid in their mind that they're constantly reliving it?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's the trauma experience is different for everyone. So some people may have the memories blacked out, and that's a, you know, a coping mechanism that their subconscious, their mind is doing for them so that they can continue on, you know. For other people, the replaying and the flashbacks are very vivid and very real. And and so there is no one, you know, you can't predict how one person's going to go through a trauma and how another person is going to go through a trauma. It really depends on the individual and their support system and everything they've experienced until that point. So, you know, we also know that trauma is cumulative. If someone has had repeated traumas, and I'll refer to quickly to a study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which was done by Kaiser Permanente and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. They co-sponsored it. And, you know, the study showed us that kids that have a high prevalence of adverse childhood experiences or trauma in their young life, on average, have a 25-year shorter lifespan. And that's largely because of the coping and health risk behaviors and sometimes mental health psychotropic drugs that are given to people who develop mental illness as a result of the trauma. But, you know, 25 years shorter lifespan is huge. And we should be, as a, you know, a nation, really realizing that if we don't stop and intervene and make childhood a more positive experience for kids, and we're exposing them or allowing them to be exposed by repeated traumas in their families and in their neighborhoods, even their communities, you know, this has a profound impact on them, their ability to, you know, to navigate the rest of their lives, really.
Yeah, and you just, you know, pretty much broke down why childhood trauma is a public health crisis, because it affects communities, you know, it affects the person throughout their lives. So you just made some, you know, pretty strong points there. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Okay, trauma-informed approach. What is that and why is it important?
So, you know, years and years ago, we used to use a medical model to diagnose somebody and to treat them. And so if someone went to a doctor and said, you know, I'm really having difficulty sleeping, I need to address this. Doctor would say, okay, person's having trouble sleeping. We're going to prescribe some sleeping medication. And so, you know, the approach was to look at the symptoms that the patient was presenting and then to try to treat it. If a person was self-injuring, it was often seen as a symptom of a mental illness. And with a trauma-informed approach, we're not saying what's wrong with this person. We're not thinking so much about what symptoms they present. We're trying to understand their story so we can understand the full picture of what's really going on with them. So instead of saying, what's wrong with this person, we ask the question, you know, what's happening to them? What are they trying to tell me? What are they trying to communicate? And how can I be helpful? And so instead of having a hierarchy where one person is providing service to a patient or a client, it's a collaborative process because no one really understands the nature and impact of any particular trauma better than the person who has lived it. They also know how they're wired, or they have the best path to find that out because it's in them. And so the approach to healing is really a collaborative one. So this is the trauma-informed approach is something that we see more and more integrated, not just into human services and primary care, but also we're seeing it now integrated into schools, where schools are emerging as trauma-sensitive environments, realizing that taking a punitive approach with kids does more harm than good, that restraining and secluding kids is not a healthy practice for them, and it absolutely should be forbidden, you know. We're starting to understand that zero-tolerance policies for bullying, that doesn't play out very well, and the outcomes of that are negative both for the victim and for the bully. So more and more we're starting to see that when we take a step back and we really try to understand, especially with kids, like their behavior is communication. So it's you see things through a different lens. Then you're not seeing a kid who's not listening, who's not sitting in their seat, who's bad and goes to the principal and maybe gets suspended or expelled, but you're seeing a kid who maybe is in the safest environment he's going to be throughout that particular day, and he's letting out some of his emotions and some of his story in one place where he feels safest. And it's at that point where we have a real opportunity to then, you know, become a healthy intervention for children. And for, you know, for adults as well, I think there are so many points of intervention, points of understanding that we will see, hopefully in my lifetime, definitely in my kids' lifetimes, but, you know, that that people are understanding how profound trauma is. And when we do that, I think we not only provide a better opportunity for people to heal, but we also give individuals the opportunity to understand what prevention could look like.
Okay. Wow, awesome. I just want to remind everyone, if you have a question regarding trauma or you just want to call in and share, you can call at 917-889-3894. That's 917-889-3894. And we're going to continue our conversation. Earlier you were describing, you know, your own personal story of trauma and what you went through. The different things that you just described, as far as your treatment, were you approached with the medical, the traditional medical treatment versus the trauma-informed approach in your own experience?
Absolutely. So it was 1993 when I was assaulted, and you know, the approach then was very much one of talk therapy, you know, and I did have sleep problems, so I was given sleep medication. But you know, it's it felt like a surface level kind of band-aid rather than some deep understanding and healing. And it was only when I started to really learn about trauma-informed care and to connect with other survivors. I think we learn so much when survivors can connect and when we talk with one another and share stories. But it was really in that way that I was able to understand what I still needed to do. And I think, you know, the healing process is different for everyone. There are some that feel that, you know, a certain period of support and treatment is great for them and they feel sort of better and back on track. There are other people like me who, you know, I know myself well enough and I know how profound that trauma was well enough to understand that my healing process will be across my entire life. So there may have been a point of healing that I wasn't able to get to before, but maybe now at this point in my life, I'm able to kind of think through and process through that. And and so it's just good to understand that it can, you know, span over some time.
Absolutely. And do you, with the work that you've done, do you find that culture plays an impact on how one deals with trauma?
Absolutely. You know, I have to say there is a wonderful author and teacher, Richard Malika, who wrote a book called Healing Invisible Wounds. And that book taught me a tremendous amount of, you know, information and insight into how different cultures heal and how people heal. There are some cultures where, you know, the family heals together. There are other cultures where you do it on your own, you know. And so the, you know, the way, or some cultures also use art as a way to heal, and that's kind of celebrated and appreciated as a community. So I think we have to understand that it's not just what happens to the person and, you know, in the whatever kind of treatments or supports are available to them. We're certainly, you know, a culture in the United States that's a blend of so many. And we have quite a few immigrants and refugees here. And so as, you know, behavioral health providers, I think it's really important to understand and appreciate that our Western models don't always work. And they don't always work for Westerners either. You know, it's really just finding the right pathway. And again, with a trauma-informed approach where you're really looking to the survivor for answers that will be helpful for them, you're letting them kind of be in the driver's seat of, and they will tell you, or maybe not in words right away, but eventually, you know, if you're listening and you're a safe person for them, they will tell you what they need.
Absolutely. Oh, okay. So we, you know, we just talked how culture is can serve as a challenge through the healing process. What are some of the other challenges when it comes to healing from trauma?
Oh, I would say probably one of the most profound challenges is just the lack of understanding of people that haven't lived through something similar. And that's part of the trauma-informed care work that needs to happen, is really educating people about the nature and impact of trauma. When I survived the attempted murder, I heard all the time from friends, and I was in my mid-20s, so, you know, very active time in life, friends going out, dancing, and having a lot of fun together. And I physically was affected to a level where I wasn't able to enjoy those things just then. And and so many of my friends had said to me, you know, just give it time and you'll get over it, or just get over it. And I think that that's such a huge mistake to say to a survivor, because you don't ever get over something that has rocked you to your core. you then, you know, you have a new place of normal. You have a new, a different way that you see and experience life and what happens around you. And so, you know, I would say that that's a really big challenge. Also from my faith community at the time, you know, I was told, let go and let God. And I thought, yeah, you know, where was God when I was assaulted? And to me, it wasn't, people weren't hearing what I was saying because I was wounded and really hurt. And there wasn't any brushing this under the carpet for me. There wasn't any, you know, just put it on the back shelf and it never happened. It happened.
Exactly.
So
and you're the one
I think, I'm sorry?
No, I said you're the one who has to live with that, you know. The other people who are saying to get over, you know, but
And you know, I think there's one other point I just I think is important to make because this is really at the core of my life philosophy, I think, when it comes to healing. And that is, I think the most important stage of the healing process isn't found in most textbooks when it comes to trauma healing. I think the most profound point of healing from trauma is when you can take the dark cloud of what happened and turn it into something positive. And that can be starting an organization, volunteering, donating, advocating. But when you can do that, you make a different meaning of the whole experience. And then it's not what happened to you anymore. It's what you're doing with it.
What you're doing with it, absolutely, absolutely. And then, you know, you brought up something very powerful when it comes to healing. It's something that's ongoing because I think a lot of people think that something is wrong with them if a certain amount of time has passed and they're still dealing with this issue. But through helping, through serving, and, you know, helping other people to get out of where you were once, you know, at one point, that's all a part of the healing process as well. So I think, you know, you just pointed out, you know, some really powerful things right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So healing through relationships and art. Can you, you know, delve into that and provide insight on that?
Sure. So a couple of years ago, I actually started a little community experiment here in Maryland where I sectioned off canvases, a head, a torso, and legs or feet, and I started passing the canvases around just to neighbors pretty much and said, you know, choose a section, whichever one you feel you want to cover, you know, whatever section you're most comfortable with. And the theme is healing from childhood experiences. And it wasn't trauma-focused. It wasn't, you know, on what violence happened to you or anything like that. It was, you know, strength-based. It was looking at what helped you heal from a bad childhood experience. And that's something that everybody has, at least one of, right? So we passed the canvases around, and what we started to see, and I did, like, you know, I had a couple of questions I would ask people before the project, before they were engaged in the project, and then some when they were done with their section on the canvas. And what my measurements were showing over time was that people were finding new strengths and understanding in their own experiences just by creating their one section of the canvas. And then those that shared a canvas, and you know, this was, each person did it in the privacy of their own home, or you know, they did it in their own time. They didn't do it collaboratively all together. So the canvases were passed around, and each person had privacy and space to create their own section. And what we found also was that the individuals that shared a canvas felt a really different level of bond. When we did an unveiling of their canvas, and they started to open up about what happened and what they were healing from and why they did their artwork a certain way, you know, they were talking about their experience in kind of a third person, but they were sharing at a level that, you know, if I had a dinner party at my house, people wouldn't open up the way they do when they talk about their artwork.
Exactly.
And so what we found over time was that these new relationships were forged, that these new connections were made, and ultimately that the experience of just this process of sharing and creating art created an environment where we were not only seeing people recognize their own personal resilience, but mm-hmm. it was building community resilience as well. So then, you know, beyond the project, people were staying in contact afterwards, providing support when there were difficult times.
Yes.
And so it expanded the support network and, you know, this is sort of community resilience in a way that was really profound. So I think art has a way of bringing people together, especially when it's a shared experience like that.
I could have been a part of that exercise. That sounds something that, you know.
Well, it's still ongoing. If you would like to do a canvas, let me know.
Okay, absolutely. Okay. So, yeah, I just wanted to cover a couple more things. What are some of the supportive resources that listeners and, you know, including myself, can use as far as, you know, healing through from different things that have happened?
Right. Well, I would say definitely, I mean, there's so much online, but I would recommend two social media groups, one in LinkedIn and one in Facebook.
Okay.
They're both called Trauma Informed, and they're by request, so you just have to send a request in. I'm the one who facilitates there, but there's a lot of really great dialogue that goes on, and it's really a platform where you can see the latest news articles, latest research, new data, you know, just really anything that is trauma-related, resources that are available, new best practices that have been highlighted. And it also becomes a place, especially the Facebook group, which has a lot more dialogue. But it's a great place to talk about certain issues or problem areas, just, you know, struggles if you're working in behavioral health or working with trauma survivors, if there's something that you were stuck on or, you know, an approach that you want to ask questions about, these communities are very supportive. And then certainly if anyone wanted to be in touch with me, I have an email address, info@traumainformed.org. So that would be the best way to reach me. But again, you know, through the LinkedIn and Facebook trauma-informed groups, that would also be another way to reach me.
Okay. So that's info@traumainformed.org in case anybody would like to get in contact with you directly. And you also have the Facebook group, the LinkedIn group, under trauma-informed, correct?
That's right.
Okay. All right, and do you have any upcoming projects or events that you'd like to share, or are you still, you know, just
I always have some things cooking, but I will say that the art project that I mentioned, we also have a Facebook group for that. It's called Art, the number 4, and then Social Change. And anyone who would like to be involved in that, we've been experimenting with a few virtual forms of it, so poetry or different kinds of writings where you can just contribute a sentence or two, photography. We're looking at some other methods of sharing and doing collaborative artworks through there. But anyone in the D.C. area that, you know, is interested in doing a canvas, certainly the invitation is open for that, and looking forward to always meeting new people and hearing new experiences.
Okay, so those who are interested in the canvas project, would they go through the Art for Social Change group?
Exactly. It's, the group on Facebook is the best way to get involved there, and again, it's Art and the number 4, and then Social Change. That's the name of the group on Facebook.
Awesome. All right. I want to thank you again for coming on. I mean, you shared tons of very useful, very powerful information, and I hope our listeners were able to, you know, take away from that. I do thank you again for coming on, Helga.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yes, and we definitely will be in touch because we want to have you back on in the future.
That would be wonderful. Looking forward
right.
to it.
Same here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, everyone. That was Helga Luis. I hope I said her name correctly. She is a speaker on trauma and has studied behavioral health, and she shares her powerful story of how she went through trauma and overcame trauma. So she shares that, and I personally have, you know, seen her speak at an event and was very impressed with what I saw and was able to take away from what she shared. So if you are interested in following up with her, again, she can be reached at info@traumainformed.org. And they also have the Facebook page under Trauma Informed. And there's also another Facebook group, ART, the number 4, Social Change, also in Facebook groups. Okay, so I just want to thank you guys again for joining us. We were able to share. If you are just now coming in at the tail end, that is okay because the replay will be up and will stay up, and you can share it as much as you see fit on your platforms to your friends and family. If you want to join us next week, we also have another great episode lined up. We were going to have a speaker. Well, actually, an author talking with us about relationships. So we're going to finalize those details and put that information up shortly after this episode. But I just wanted to give you guys a sneak peek. So, again, if you want to connect with us and keep in touch with us, please connect with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/LaFemmePros. We are also on Twitter, @FocusOnWomen3. That's @FocusOnWomen, the number 3. And if you are interested in putting your story together or putting your memoirs together and through writing, that is something that I can help you with. And I can be reached at new3creations@gmail.com. That's new3creations@gmail.com. Again, my name is Musu, and you are listening to La Femme de Prose podcast. And we will see you next week. Thank you so much for joining.
Great things are happening at your friendly neighborhood Safeway. Stop by and see all the things that make a supermarket just better, like new low everyday prices on family favorites. Shop with your club card and pick up bananas for an incredible 48 cents a pound. And for an easy, delicious dinner, get whole roasted chicken for only $4.98. Bigger selections, friendlier smiles, lower prices. Safeway, it's just better.
Getting lost in the music is great, except if you're driving. Nissan's available Intelligent Safety Shield technologies could help you avoid bad drivers. Hurry into your local Nissan store and get great offers during the Safety Today event. Or shop ChooseNissan.com today. Now, back to the music.